for 276. 276. I would be amiss if I didn't thank, in the very beginning, the congregation as a collective unit for inviting me to be here in this week. Until yesterday, I had only known in person two people, and that, of course, is the Goldens, whose sister, Brother Golden, Goldie, I'm practicing on his nickname. Kind of like Ken Long we met before services. His daddy hit him over the head telling him to call people Mr. and Brother. My daddy did the same thing, but I'll try to do that. I had only met them one time in Richmond. His sister worships there, Sister Nosker, and you may be familiar with her. But I'm very thankful to them for their kindness that they have shown me in the visit that we have had previously, and for your invitation as a congregation to come here and to be with you in this week. I have enjoyed very much getting to know the Geyers. Brother and Sister Geyer have extended me the kindness of allowing me to come into their home and to be with them this week, and it is a joy. Alicia and Derek are a joy to be with. I have a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old at home. Alicia's a lot like my daughter, who's 10 years old. I don't know Derek if he's a lot like my 6-year-old or not, but anyway, it's good to get to know him. No, he's 14, and I know that. And it's good to be with those brethren and to meet so many of you and to have an occasion to be with you through this week will be a joy unspeakable, I am very certain. I would be also amiss if I didn't get a little mileage out of the fact that we have one of the brethren from Richmond where I preach here this morning. She's driven 437 miles to hear me preach. And that's just great. That's not really true. Her mother lives in Newport, Ohio, which is just down here across the river. And they are both here, Sister Pryor and her daughter Virginia Meyer. And it's good to see them. And I look forward to getting to visit with Virginia's mother while I am here in such a close area to where she lives. I came across a fictitious story some time back. It is obviously fictitious. A challenge to Satan offered to his band of evil spirits that surrounded him. The story goes that Satan asked his evil spirits, "Who will go and accomplish the ruin of men's souls? What will be your clever appeal? What will you do? What would you say? What could you say? How would you convince men to turn away from the ways of God?" Well, the first spirit came forward and he said, "I will go, and I will tell men that there is no heaven." Satan said, "No, that will not work. For too many centuries, man has been told that there is a heaven, and our enemy God has given man a book. A book that promises heaven. A place where there is no tears and no pain, there is no death, a place where there is no suffering, no sorrow, or any tribulation of any sort. And you will never be able to convince men that there is no heaven." The second of his spirits came forward, and he said, "I will go and I will tell people that there is no hell." Satan again said, "No, that will not work. If nothing else, the very conscience of man tells him that there is a hell. There must be a place of final justice, a place of punishment for the wicked. No, you will never convince man that there is no hell." Satan continued, "I need somebody. Somebody who can make an appeal that will appeal to everyone, to every class of people, to all nations and ages and tongues, to all cultures and all countries." Finally, the third spirit glided forward and he said, "I will go and I will not tell people that there is no heaven and I will not tell people that there is no hell. I will tell men that there is no hurry. There is no hurry. I think you recognize, as I do this morning, that this is Satan's master plan of propaganda. And he has perpetrated it across this land and throughout the world, and he has convinced men that there is no hurry. I am certain that even among those who assemble here in this very auditorium this morning, or those who are guilty of convincing themselves that there is no hurry, and yet you have not convinced yourselves at all it is Satan's plan. You know this plan. You know it very well. It's the plan that tells you, hey, don't sweat it. You have plenty of time. Put it off. After all, you have tomorrow and next year or next month or at least you have next week. There's no hurry. Do it later. There's a four-bit word that is descriptive of this satanic strategy that I believe to be a constant habit of man. It's a constant habit even of my own shortcomings. And that's this word, procrastination. I didn't come here this morning to appeal to your intellect through flowery speech. I'm not capable of that, or great oratory. I'm not capable of that either. I'm not here to tell you stories. I'm here to tell you about a man by the name of Felix in Acts chapter 24. I believe Felix to have been the master of procrastination. It was part of his nature. It was part of his everyday activities. And I'm convinced that it's part of ours. You see, procrastination has a very broad appeal. It's much broader than just the spiritual realm of decision making that we're going to talk about in a moment. But it permeates virtually every aspect of our own lives. At least it does mine. And I'm convinced others. As students, doing our studies, answering our mail, paying our bills, losing weight, dealing with conflicts, and last of all, we procrastinate in doing the most dreaded of all of our activities, our tax returns. I don't know about you, I did mine on the 14th. We procrastinate. We're good at procrastinating in all areas of our lives. We procrastinate when it comes to doing projects around the house. It must have been my wife who wrote the words. When a man does a household job, he goes through three periods. First, contemplating how it will be done. Second, contemplating when it will be done. And third, just contemplating. That's right. I think that is so very true. One writer said, procrastination is my sin. It brings me naught with sorrow. And I know that I shall stop it. And I will. Tomorrow. It's so true. And yet, of all of the areas of our lives, when it comes to the subject of procrastination that needs the most impassioned attention and yet gets the least, it has got to be our spiritual lives. It has to be. This number is like most others. Perhaps there are those that are in this assembly this morning who are alien sinners who have never known the forgiveness of the blood of Jesus Christ provides. Perhaps there are those this morning who have heard, as they say, enough gospel to convert the world, and yet they've never acted on it. They've never chosen to serve the Lord. They've never actively pursued His commands in obedience. And yet, this morning, you are no closer to obeying the gospel than you were 2 or 3 or even 10 years ago, maybe. I got a call the other day from some of the brethren where I preached in Houston, Mississippi for 5 years. When you've moved away from a place where you were as close to the brethren as we were, and you love them dearly, they know you're concerned about them. The telephone rings, and it's one of them who doesn't normally contact you. You automatically think that something has happened. Brother was calling to tell me about a friend of mine who I had had occasion to study with on many occasions, many times, and yet he never obeyed the gospel while I was there. He was in his 60s, not in very good health. The telephone rings and they said, "I called to tell you about Bob." Well, you fear the worst and you know what's coming. He said, "Bob obeyed the gospel today." And he asked me first if I was sitting down. And I was. And I was tickled to death. You don't get many of those kind. Usually it's the other. Usually it's what you were expecting me to say. Why is that? Here is a man who had heard the gospel. He had been married for, 30 years or more. His wife has been a New Testament Christian. His children were New Testament Christians. No one could understand what Bob's problem was. "Bob, why aren't you any closer 10 years ago to obey the gospel today than you were 10 years ago?" And he wasn't. And yet finally he quit procrastinating. Maybe there are some of you here today. Perhaps there are those who are erring Christians who need to repent and turn from the wicked ways of this world. The appeals of Satan to procrastinate and put off faithfulness. Faithfulness that perhaps you've put off for years and years and years. Finally, maybe there are those who are among the number of this assembly this morning who are no more mature in your walk with God today than you were 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. Why is that? Why is it that we're not growing? Friends, we believe the lie. We believe the lie of Satan that there is no hurry. Sure, there's a heaven. I know there's a hell. A fool would deny those things. But after all, there's always tomorrow. I'll do it later. As some of you may know, there is not always tomorrow. We have not that promise. And Satan may convince us otherwise. But Satan has been a liar from the beginning, described as the father of lies. I want to talk to you about the classic text of dealing, or I should say exposing, procrastination for exactly what it is. In the 27 verses that are contained in Luke's record of the book of Acts, the 24th chapter, you find the scene is painted for us by this rather fluent writer. And beginning in the first stages of the chapter, you find that the scene is of the lives of two characters. One who is a prisoner, whose name was Paul, formerly Saul of Tarsus. And the second, there is a politician, whose name is Felix. While one man preached, we find the other man procrastinated. While one man served God faithfully, the other put off doing what he knew he ought to do. As we mentioned a moment ago, we will find as we study this text that this man was the kind of man who put off doing what was right, and he did it often. Procrastination is nothing new. To Felix, an individual who procrastinated in all aspects of his life, he was a master of knowing how to continually put something off. My wife would tell you that I'm that kind of a person. She has all kinds of little projects for me to do around the house. I was over at one of the brethren's house the other day in Richmond. We were passing by. He was out in the yard. And when you drive by the brethren's house in Richmond, we live so far apart, we thought he might have seen us. We were in a hurry, but we said, "We better stop because we may get accused of just passing him by." So we did. And I asked him, I said, "What are you doing, brother?" He said, "I'm doing honeydews. Honeydew this and honeydew that." Well, I thought that was a good response. I need probably to get on some of my honeydews. When they kind of collect up like they have the last few weeks, I go away in a meeting. But in verse 25 of this record, we find that Felix became frightened at what Paul taught him. And he said, "Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you." He procrastinated. He put it off. Well, that's where we're going to end up this morning. I want to spend the rest of our time looking at the text and note some of the things that occurred that led up to this circumstance. And if we can paint, if you will, in a picture in our mind's eye of procrastination. Perhaps we'll be so appalled at what the man did that we'll be able to get it out of our lives once and for all. Relating to the spiritual matters of the soul, the things that are so very important, which bring us here today. The section begins with a series of accusations made against the prisoner whose name we have said is Paul. Paul stands accused in the court of law by one who is a professional politician by the name of Tertullus. He was a Roman lawyer hired by the Jews to state the grounds for prosecution and hopeful execution of the man. We begin reading in verse 1 as Luke records, after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with certain orator named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, the very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence. We accept it always, in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness, notwithstanding, that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words." This man is very apparently, to even the most casual reader, trained. He's had all of the education that he needed. He's had all of the training as a speaker. He certainly would have the political clout to have at least commanded some attention of this governor. And he stood before this man and he said, "Let me tell you how great we think you are." And having said that, then he begins to lay down one by one, very cleverly, in a very skilled way, using all of the means of legal argumentation that he's learned, no doubt well paid for his services. And he begins to lay these down one by one, and he lays down 3 basic charges. First of all, we found this man a real pest. Some of your modern versions say it like that, but if you'll begin reading with me, or back into the text as we read, verse 5, "For we have found this man a pestilent fellow," a pest. Think about that for just a moment, the general accusation against Paul's character and his movement. This man is a pest. Brethren, I've been called a lot of things. I don't know I've ever been called a pest. My mother had a lot of names for me, as I know your mother probably had for you. Most of all, she calls me Michael Wynn. But Paul here was called a pest. Now, friends, this is a slight against him, intended to make this man look as though he were small, as though he had attained no position or had no respect of those of his peers, had no reputation, and what of the reputation of Saul of Tarsus, I ask you? He was among the highest of the people who lived in Palestine of that day as far as reputation among the Jews. And he had risen to certain stature among the brethren, respected and appreciated at least by those who really knew him. An apostle of God, and yet he's called by this man a pest. He's a pestilent fellow. The first charge, he goes on to say, a mover of insurrection among the Jews throughout the world. He's a blight on society. He's a threat to peace. Read with me if you will. A mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world. A ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Actually, 2 charges contained in that verse. This insurrection, a threat to the peace. There were Jews, as we understand, those who are familiar with Bible times, there were Jews scattered throughout the known world of that day, throughout the Roman Empire, the empire that Felix served as a governor of at least one portion of. He's a threat to peace. He's begun to raise up an army, if you will, that would threaten the Caesar. Oh, this man has to be dealt with. Not only a threat to peace here, but everywhere. A mover of insurrection, a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, a cultic leader. This man is a religious fanatic. You ever been called a religious fanatic? Some of us maybe have been called fanatics for believing something so strongly, willing to stand up in the face of adversity, not willing to procrastinate where the cause of Christ is concerned, but put it first and foremost in our minds. The Apostle Paul here is called, if you will, a religious fanatic. He's unstable. Why? Why, he's a ringleader of that sect of the Nazarenes. You remember the Nazarenes, that's the one who troubled us so terribly all those years and was finally put to death on a cross, crucified by the Romans with the cries of the Jew in affirmation of it. Well, he's a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. This man has to be dealt with. This man's now taken up the torch of that one. He's prompting the proclamation and observance of an unauthorized religion. Judaism was tolerated by Rome for a period of time. And Christianity began to take hold and began to go throughout the world. And early on, we find that the Romans had finally become fed up with the Jews, blaming the Jews for many bad things, even that happened as far away as Rome, and finally they destroyed them. That hasn't happened quite yet. But he is trying to convince, this orator is standing up before the governor, and he is trying to convince him that this is an unauthorized religion in the eyes of Rome. And if he can convince this governor of that, then the governor will have no choice but to put the man to death for insurrection against the Roman Caesar. Thirdly, this man also hath gone about to profane the temple. In verse 6. You'll remember the occasion that they are speaking of in which Paul supposedly profaned the temple. It's found in the 21st chapter, beginning in verse, actually it begins in about verse 27. Paul had come to Jerusalem hoping to be there for Pentecost to preach the gospel. The best occasion for the Apostle Paul to accomplish the purpose, he had brought an offering from those churches in Achaia and Macedonia. And he'd come there for peaceful purposes, to preach the gospel to people who wanted to hear. The apostle had desires to go into other parts of the world, but his first great desire, as he stated in the 10th chapter of the book of Romans, was to see his brethren saved, Jewish brethren, that is. And we find him as he comes into the city, there are those among him that convince him that there is a great dispute going on among the Jews against Paul. They intend to put him to death if they can. They believe him to be leading blasphemous, or teaching blasphemous things about God and the law and Moses and the temple. They're convinced of that. They're so very certain of that. And they convinced Paul that the only way that he could show those people otherwise is for him to purify himself in the temple. A period of 7 days of purification we find are ongoing when we pick the account up in verse 27. They were almost ended. And the Jews which were of Asia, notice these are not Jews from Palestine. These are not Jews from Judea or Samaria in the surrounding area at all. They're from Asia, far away. They've been following Paul around the country for years. They follow him here. The Jews from Asia, when they saw him in the temple, they stirred up all the people, laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is a man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place being the temple. And further brought Greeks also into the temple and hath polluted this holy place." Notice now, the writer inserts verse 29. "For they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple." They never saw him in the temple. They never saw him there. Paul had tremendous respect for the temple. Paul would never have done that. Paul would have never, knowing his upbringing, the kind of man that he was, would have never done this. He knew, first of all, the kind of harm that it would do. You know, I'm convinced that gospel preachers of wisdom, they choose very carefully in their actions. They're very careful what they say. Not that they would withhold from teaching the truth, mind you, but they use a little tact in doing it. Paul was that kind of a man. He always was. He was always respectful of those about him. Willing to do what was ever necessary and consistent with the teachings of Christ to accomplish the cause of Christ. And this man is now being accused of polluting the temple and bringing this Ephesian into the temple. No, he hadn't done it. Luke tells us exactly what the people had supposed, and it was all supposition. All the city was moved, and the people ran together. They took Paul, drew him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. And as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. Notice all of the call, or all of the harm that had been brought about in this tumult that's going on in the city. Who is the cause, mind you? Not Paul. It's those Jews from Asia. They were about to kill him. Tidings came to the chief captain of this uproar, who immediately took soldiers and centurions, ran down unto them, and when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. Then the chief captain came near, took him, commanded him to be bound to two chains, and demanded who he was and what he had done to deserve this. What has he done? Tell me what he's done. The man just wanted to determine the truth in the matter, wanted to find out exactly what the man was guilty of. No? Hadn't have been guilty of anything, really, because you find in verse 34, some cried one thing, some another, among the multitude, when they could not know the certainty. For the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. Now I want you to keep that in your mind for just a moment, exactly what had led to Paul being brought to this into this situation. And find out he hadn't profaned the temple at all. The people had supposed he had, and most of the people involved in this great tumult, this great tribulation that had been brought about in this city, most of them didn't even know what had caused it. They just kind of got caught up in the emotion of the thing. On the side, back to Acts 24, you find Paul sitting very quietly. He has just heard the words, he has desecrated our temple, we arrested him, this man had no respect for the religious convictions of others, this man is guilty as charged. That's what we heard. That's what he heard. And yet he sits very quietly, very reserved. This was, I granted, required by law. He couldn't speak while the formal charges were being presented. But notice his confidence. I think there's more to it. When an individual knows that he or she is right, when your actions are God-pleasing, you've done nothing whereof to be ashamed of, you have no problem holding your peace. You have no problem to sit very quietly. Don't panic. There's no reason to panic. There's no reason to lose control of myself and my emotions. I need to keep a clear head because my life here may be on the line. The cause of Christ may be in jeopardy in us. We have no problem sitting by, letting a man have his say, and then rising with a proper spirit and a proper attitude without excitement and speak. Paul did just that. He waited patiently. He listened while this well-versed, well-compensated, high-flying attorney, if you will, began to speak. And then he stood and noticed the honesty of his response. False witnesses had come against him, had said, yes, this is so. These charges are true. This is what happened. Paul, after that, the governor had beckoned to him to speak, answered, "For as much as I know that thou hast been for many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself." Cheerfully, as the New American Standard Version, I think, says, make my defense. Notice that. Very carefully, very poignant, respectful. Spoke. I think there are many lessons here to be learned from the way Paul addressed the man. Notice his respect he showed him, without question. He didn't do what Tertullus had done. He didn't try to impress the man with how much he knew about him. He knew he'd been a judge for many years in that region. We know that the man, Felix, had served throughout the Roman Empire in various areas of the country. We know he was a very capable man in many ways. We know a lot about him. You'd be surprised. Paul knew all of those things, and yet Paul didn't try to impress him. Paul didn't try to, without presenting evidence, get him over to his side like Tertullus had done. Paul just said, "I know you'll judge honestly in this matter, and here it is. Here's the situation. Here's what was done. And I think it teaches us a lot of lessons. As we mentioned, I think there's some things we could learn as New Testament Christians. You know, we get in situations that are kind of intense at times, and we're called on to act or make a decision or to say something or to respond to something, and we're caught by surprise. We don't quite know what to do sometimes. But Paul teaches us here there's always some safe things we can do. Some safe things to say that are true and right. Gospel preacher is in kind of a predicament at times when you stand at the back of the church building, as I do, when people are exiting and you're meeting and greeting people. And invariably in a congregation of this size and where I am, you'll have a new baby that'll come in to the brethren. It'll be born or adopted or something of that nature. And they'll bring that baby in their little carriage as they carry it out of this little hand carrier. And they'll pull back the covers to show the preacher the new baby. And what do you say? You pull back the covers of one of those things every now and then, and all babies are not cute, despite how pretty mine were. What do you say to that person? Well, I'll tell you what you say. When they come back, you pull back those, and the mother and daddy are looking at you, and they're looking for your response. You say, "Oh, what a baby." And see, they're just convinced that that's the most beautiful baby in the world because they believe that it is. The brethren are kind of in a, thinking of that makes me think of the predicament the brethren are in as they're exiting the building. The gospel preacher standing back there and he's shaking everybody's hand and he's wanting to know, if you're like me, you're wanting to know how it was, you know. And as they come by one, you're looking for some kind of a response, and maybe you've preached a sermon that just wasn't any good at all. And you want to tell him that it was a good sermon, but you can't because it wasn't any good. And you don't want to tell him it was a bad sermon because you don't want to hurt his feelings. What do you tell him? Now, I'll tell you what you say. You shake his hand and you say, "Brother, that sermon was unique. I never heard one like it." And that's true. And he smiles and he thinks like I do, "What a great sermon that was." Now, you can't use that one today. I'm in on that. But Paul, very carefully and properly, never wavering in his focus, said, "I cheerfully make my defense." And in verse 11 through 21, I want to show you the contrast as we try to bring this to a close of Paul's response and Felix's response. Or excuse me, in Tertullus's statement. Tertullus had asserted charges. The only proof was the assent of witnesses which could not be trusted. And Felix could see that. Paul stands up and he says to the circumstance, I've turned too far. Chapter 24, verse 11. "Because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. They neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up people, neither in synagogues nor in the city, neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. I confess unto thee that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets, and have hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men. Now after many years I came to bring alms to my nations and offering, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee and object, if they had aught against me. Or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried, standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question to you or by you this day." That must be it. The fact that I believe in the resurrection of the dead, that must be why I'm here. None of this other stuff can be substantiated. The first charge is, Paul said, the first evidence, not charge, the first evidence he offers is, "I've only been here for 12 days. 7 of those days he spent in purification," which he would not have been able to have been involved in that. Every Jew had to admit that. five of which he had waited for this trial. Where are the days? Which day of the 12? I've been busy all 12. There's no way I could have ever been involved in that. You see, Paul has the perfect alibi. He could not be guilty of these charges. And the rest of what he says hinges on the fact that we see as readers and students the fact that Paul could never have done this, and Felix saw it and he saw it right away. He could have stopped him right there and said, that's enough. I've heard all I need to know. You prove otherwise. You charged him. Now you show some proof. Without any proof, there was no trial. There was no need for a trial. And it would have been thrown out of court. And yet he continues and he says, in defense of himself, they cannot prove the charges. They've neither seen me in the synagogue, they haven't seen me with people, nor in the city, neither in the temple itself, raising any kind of insurrection against the Roman rule or Judaism. None of it is so. I'll confess this to you. Yes, I'm a worshiper of God. I believe the law and the prophets. I ask it to you this morning. You bet. You bet. With the Apostle Paul, we stand and say amen. In affirmation of what he says, indeed, we believe all of these things. We have hope toward God, looking for the resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And here's where we need to recognize a very important point. It's already come up once in the course of Paul's, the trials that Paul's been through. When he stood before the Sanhedrin council, that is this great council of Jewish leaders with a high priest being their leader. Charges had been made in an earlier chapter, and you can turn over and you can read in chapter 23 of these events if you want. The same charges. And Paul perceived something. Paul recognized that part of these were of the sect of the Sadducees. Part of these were of the sect of the Pharisees. Now the difference in the two is the Sadducees don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. That's sad, you see. That they don't. And yet the Pharisees affirm that it is so, that there will be a general resurrection of both the just and the unjust. Paul perceived that and then began and made the statement concerning the resurrection of the dead in verse 6. Paul perceived the one part of the Sadducees. This is 23, chapter 23 and verse 6. Others Pharisees. He cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, the hope and resurrection of the dead. I am called in questioner for that hope. He split the party. He divided his accusers. A house divided against itself, Jesus said, cannot stand. It's exemplified here because the arguments began to fall apart one by one. And as they fall apart, the Pharisees stood up in unison and said, we find no fault with this man. Turn him loose. Of course, they were in on the plot in the latter part of the chapter. They couldn't dispose of him in this way because then they would be kind of turning on themselves. So they thought they'd just kill him in secret. And that's what led to him being sent now to Felix. Well, these things are all so. Paul said, I am a firm believer in the resurrection of the dead. That must be why they're charging me. Well, what would the Pharisees be able to say? No, that's not why you're here. Hold it just a minute. That's not why you came. That's not why we brought you here. Paul has completed his statement before the council, before Felix now. No proof was offered. His accusers were in Jerusalem. They weren't even here. Many of them had probably left to go home to Asia. They didn't come down. They didn't see a sufficient need to come down and accuse him. Number two, the council, they were here, and the council could offer no proof of any guilt that was found in him in the council meeting. Remember, it was adjourned with a dispute among the Sadducees and Pharisees. So the decision is left on the man, Felix. Felix heard these things, verse 22, having more perfect knowledge of that way, speaking of Christianity, and I'm convinced of Judaism. And the King James says he deferred them. He put it off. See, the account we read in verse 25 is not the only time Felix put something off. He put this off. He didn't make a decision. He says, well, we'll send for Claudius Lysias to come down here. When Claudius Lysias comes down, then I'll know the whole of the matter. I'll be able to judge in the matter. Well, he had a written letter that's contained very plainly in earlier chapters from Claudius Lysias in the latter part of chapter 23, where Claudius Lysias lays down one by one his part of the his knowledge in the matter. He had everything he needed to make a decision, and yet he didn't want to make a decision. He wanted to put it off. He didn't want to talk about it, and he did. He put them off, and he sent Paul with the centurion. He sent him back to jail, if you will, to be held, and he gave him liberty. That is, he was able to have visitors. He was able to have people to care for him. And he also was in a position that Lysias could go in. Felix sent him there, and Felix was in a position to go and see him. And this is the second of the situations that we find the two in. Commanded the centurion in verse 23 to keep him, let him have liberty, that he should forbid none of his acquaintances to minister to him or come into him. And after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. What did Paul do on that occasion? Paul came in and he preached the truth to the man. Notice as you continue reading the text in verse 25, exactly what he did concerning this faith in Christ from verse 24. He reasoned of righteousness and temperance and judgment to come. Righteousness concerning those things which are right according to the law of God, the commands of God, if you will, the teachings of Christ, and what this man needed to do in order to put off the sin of his past. And the sins of Felix and Drusilla were tremendous because, number one, he had seduced Drusilla away from another man. We know that. Secular history records the record. You see, this is the great-granddaughter of a great man, of a man who had lived some years before, a man that we know to be Herod the Great. And this woman, Drusilla, had been married to another and was, if you will, enticed away from this man. And Felix had taken her to be his wife, a woman that he had absolutely no right to. The same kind of circumstance that we find John the Baptist standing up against and condemning the ruler of that day for the evil and his sin of having a woman that he did not have a right to. And so he preached concerning righteousness of God. Well, I think there's little doubt what he probably told the two. That's another lesson, and we don't really have time to consider it. But think about the fact that he condemned this man and his sin. And this man is convicted of this sin. He talked about self-control with righteousness. This is something that had been long lost among these two, their unbridled passions for one another and what brought them together, don't you see? He preached concerning self-control and doing what was right in the eyes of God because it was right. And he preached to him finally of judgment to come. There is a hell you will know if you don't make correction. And Felix and Drusilla, you're going to have to answer for your sin. You're going to have to answer if you could persist in the kind of relationship that you are presently in. And I ask you, are you today in this assembly in the kind of relationship with Satan that you've yoked yourself together with him in sin? Dear friends, the Bible is explicit concerning hell and the fact that we're going to be judged for our sin. The Lord himself in John chapter 12 and verse 48 told us concerning the law and our need to be obedient to it. He that rejecteth me and receiveth not my words hath one that judgeth him. The word that I have spoken, the same will judge him in the last day. The Bible is very plain about that. Judgment will come. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10. The Apostle Paul said that there will be absolutely no escape for any man, no matter who it may be, for every accountable being. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ to receive the things that are done in the body, whether they be good or bad. According to that, he hath done, whether it be good or bad. I ask you, can you relate to the circumstance that these were in? that you need to make a change. You need to make correction in your life for some wrong that you've been guilty of committing. Maybe you're a child of God, an erring Christian, and you've put off doing what you know you need to do. Are you any closer today than you were before you walked in those doors? I hope you are after this sermon. I hope it has at least some impact on you to consider this man and recognize, oh, the need he had. And Drusilla as well, to make correction in the eyes of God. He had knowledge of that way. And Paul didn't let him down when he called for Paul to preach to him. But what did he do? You continue reading in this text. You find in verse 25 that he reasoned of righteousness and these things we've talked about. Felix trembled. He shook in his boots, if you will. And he said, go away, for the time when I have a convenient season, I will call.